From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. When Oregon legalized cannabis, it was like a floodgate opening of small and large businesses gearing up to sell to an eager public. And in some ways, that was the problem. So many growers and retailers saw the lure of easy money that the market was inundated with the product. And as any economist will tell you, when supply outstrips demand, prices fall. Today on the show, we talk with a reporter at the Oregon Journalism Project about her recent story, which shows that cheap pot equals less than expected taxes, which, as was set up when cannabis was legalized, equals lower revenue to fund mental health and addiction services. Then, in the second part of the show, you'll hear from our newest reporter about a new youth center helping our communities most vulnerable. That's next on Oregon on the Record. Legalized marijuana in Oregon has been a decidedly mixed bag. Yes, it's created wealth and created taxation to help with programs at the state level, but not as much as hoped. Today on the show, the Oregon Journalism Project explains how the economics of pot and the resulting drag on mental health services is concerning. Khushbu Rathore, a reporter with the Oregon Journalism Project, great talking to you again. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks so much for jumping on and talking with us. I read the article you recently did about sort of some of the challenges with the Oregon pot business. And I wanted to start with this. Can you kind of explain for people who may not remember how cannabis money is tied to behavioral health funding in Oregon?
Yeah, absolutely. So Measure 110, which decriminalized a lot of different drugs, also established these behavioral health resource networks, which is a grant program that the Oregon Health Alliance manages. And so a certain portion of revenue, I believe it was around, it's now around $13 million of the pot revenue goes towards a bunch of other programs, including the State School Fund, Oregon State Police, et cetera. And that's capped at a certain number. And then the rest all goes towards this behavioral health resource network grant program.
Okay. So what is the state of revenue for pot in Oregon?
It's been steadily decreasing. And, you know, I talked to kind of an expert who's the Colin Hobbs chair of the Cannabis Industry Alliance of Oregon. And he said that without some pretty significant changes, he doesn't see it getting much better because, you know, Oregon growers are just growing more pot than the state can consume.
And so obviously too much pot, the basics of economics, it's supply and demand. There's too much supply. And so that's driving prices down.
Yep, exactly.
Okay. And then so kind of pull that string a little bit farther. So how does that impact, you know, this funding for behavioral health? I mean, it's just less tax revenue?
Yeah, so the Behavioral Health Resource Network is fully dependent on that tax revenue. They have no other funding that comes through to them. Obviously, the Opioid Settlement Board did kind of step in to provide some of this money that they're anticipating a shortfall of, but they only get money from this tax revenue, and the tax revenue is, I believe, a flat 17% of recreational sales. So it really makes a huge difference. If they're not getting that money anymore, then these programs that they're funding may have to let go of certain people, may have to make hard choices that could impact this program's ability to provide care for people.
And are we already seeing some of those impacts? Can you kind of draw a through line between the lower pot tax revenue and perhaps layoffs or just, you know, kind of suspension of certain services?
It's hard to say. One of the weird things about the Behavioral Health Resource Network grants is that they're awarded on a four-year cycle. So their most recent awarding was this past July, I believe, July 2025, where they awarded grants that will be released incrementally to all of these programs for over the next 4 years. One thing they did say in their presentation to the Opioid Settlement Board is that they don't want that money to be inconsistent. So if they see this continuing decline in revenue, right, they're going to have to say, sorry, we can't give you all the money that we promised. We're going to have to give you a little less. And I'm sure that would impact services in some way, but I could not say exactly how that would look.
Okay. I also read in your report that, you know, Oregon, we have some unique challenges here where, in terms of illicit drug use, of which, you know, some of this tax money goes towards addiction services. Talk about this sort of perfect storm of we're not getting enough tax revenue, even though we have a big problem.
Yeah, so all of this tax revenue obviously is coming from legalized marijuana sales, right? There's no taxation on these illicit sales that may be happening and, you know, illicit growers that are maybe shipping out of the state, which isn't legal to do. So we can only tax what is legally happening and what we legally know of. So even if there is, you know, more fentanyl, more heroin, more cocaine, those kinds of transactions aren't necessarily taxed.
Yeah, yeah. Let me reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking to Khushbu Rathore, who is a reporter with the Oregon Journalism Project. You mentioned earlier talking to, you know, Cullen Hobbs, the chair of the Cannabis Industry Alliance of Oregon. Are there possible sort of just general economic factors that might even this all out, i.e., you know, if the growers are growing too much pot, is that going to, in some ways, I mean, does that sort of take care of itself in that growers are probably going to go out of business because obviously they can't be making a lot of money? Is there a potential for this to sort of right itself based on, you know, economies of scale?
I can't say that I know if it'll right itself. I can say that one of the things that Colin said was he has seen some growers merging or going out of business, but because it's kind of this three-step process, right? You have growers who are actually growing the crop, then it goes to processors, and then it goes to these sellers. It can take a little while for that change in money and revenue to kind of trickle down and actually have an impact on growers.
Okay. I realize this is a question that's probably asking for some conjecture here, but especially with the people that you talk to, I mean, has legalization of pot been a success in Oregon? Obviously, you know, a lot of people enjoy recreational pot, and so it's become a good size business. But it also seems like your story points out there's some real problems here. Is it that, because it's still a fairly nascent industry, that these are sort of bugs that are almost any new industry might face? Or are there some baked in challenges to the pot industry in Oregon that we're really starting to see foment after it's been, you know, a little less than a decade since it became legalized?
Yeah. One of the things Colin said is that, you know, the state has not done a very good job of managing things like licensing. You know, they had open licensing for a long period of time, and then they changed it. And now I believe it's per capita licensing, but I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
So he said that, you know, the state has not necessarily done the best job of supporting what their, you know, original mission was, which was these supporting these small growers, right? And it's kind of pivoted from that, or not necessarily fulfilling that and fulfilling the small business model.
Okay. And obviously, this has been sort of a strange child, if you will, because it's legal in Oregon and other states. But of course, there's still the issue of it being not legal federally. And of course, that means it can't be banked as like other businesses. So my question for you is kind of, you know, if, and certainly the Trump administration has made some overtures about potentially making it legal nationally. I mean, if that were to come to pass, would some of this glut maybe be taken care of? Because then these growers could export their product across state lines, which, as I understand, they cannot do now. I'm just wondering if federalization or federal legalization of pot might also help in this regard.
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the things that Colin really highlighted in our conversation, was that federal legalization, the ability for Oregon to ship out both, you know, now it has this established growers industry. It has, you know, relatively good marijuana from what I understand.
Okay.
But the ability to kind of start shipping that out of state and making these other deals would really assist growers in having more financial stability. And, you know, he shared his own story of previously having a company go bankrupt and how much that financially impacted him because, you know, banks wouldn't work with him and he couldn't really get any restitution for everything that happened. He still had to pay a bunch of taxes on, you know, sales he wasn't really able to make or make an income off of. So I think there is a lot that could change and become better for growers if there's federal legalization.
Okay. And then Kashpreet, my last question for you is sort of intrastate is could it be that there's just going to be so much, there's going to be a lot of consolidation. So you might have, you know, four or five super growers that buy everybody else up and then can kind of, they perhaps control more the amount of crop that's been planted so that they could drive up prices. Is that a fear that maybe someone like Colin Hobbs talked about?
I can't say. I will say he mentioned that there are already some growers that, you know, are multi-state and they have to have that financial ability because to do multi-state production, you have to have basically a corporation and a company set up in every single state. And then I believe you can work with either the FDA or the DEA to transport across state lines within legal areas, but it requires a lot more money.
Yeah. Interesting and a complex industry. Kashpu Rathore, who writes for the Oregon Journalism Project, really appreciate you explaining all this and this complex industry that is the pot industry in Oregon. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Let's now hear about a new youth center helping kids with nowhere else to go. Macy Moore, they're a reporter with us here at KLCC. Macy, thanks so much for coming down and talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I enjoyed your recent story about the Jackson Street Youth Center. You know, just tell people what that was about. Talk about your story and what you found out.
Yeah, for sure. So I recently did sort of a longer piece about the Jackson Street Youth Service Center, which Jackson Street Youth Services is like a nonprofit that's been running in Albany and Corvallis area since like the mid-90s.
Okay.
And they were in like a smaller service center. They're a nonprofit that combats youth homelessness. So they work with kind of ages like 12 to 24-ish youth. Okay. And young adults. They can put you in emergency housing or help you get like housing support in an apartment.
Yeah, and then a large part of your story was about this sort of drop-in component. Talk
yes.
about the importance of that.
Yes, so the drop-in component, they sort of told me is like a prevention measure almost. So the drop-in component is whenever they're open for drop-in hours, anyone ages 12 to 24 can come in and like use the laundry service, use their bathrooms, use their kitchen, go through the food pantry, the hygiene closet, look at the clothing closet, and just kind of get those resources. And that comes into the prevention of homelessness because sometimes it's a financial issue. Sometimes it's just like, I don't know, you can't afford toothpaste this month, and they
sure.
don't mind if you just come in there and get some toothpaste and leave.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're in need of that bigger support, the staff will work with you to get you to like mental health counseling, to their emergency housing services. They can connect you with like queer resources if you're LGBT. There was just like a lot of stuff going on in there, and I thought it was a really cool place to highlight.
Yeah, yeah. Well, talk a little bit about what the center's leadership told you about sort of the needs they're fulfilling. Is are they seeing an expansion of youth who need their help?
So the motivation to move into this bigger center was that they were getting like so overwhelmed with resources and donations and wanted the center to not only serve as like a hub where you can, you know, go get resources, like go get those physical items, but also as like a hangout space. And in their much smaller center, it was four times smaller than the new building they moved into. There was like no place to really have that like lounge area where like young people can sit and hang out and meet others and use the kitchen and stuff. That was all, there was too many donations, which is probably a good issue to have.
Sure.
Like, you want the community to support you and love your nonprofit and donate those items. But also, they were just feeling that they had a need for somewhere in between, like emergency housing and nothing, or like they'll go to schools or community centers and do like little events. There needed like a between area, somewhere where you could get connected to those resources without it being extreme, I guess, is the best way I can put it.
Yeah. And I was listening to your story, it seems like you've talked about this a little bit, but I'll expand if you could. Sort of there's the drop in and then there's the outreach. What does that mean? Do they actually go out in the community and provide services, that sort of a thing?
Yeah. So the other half of the building is also an expanded office space for their outreach staff. It also has like a private counseling room where people can do private sessions with like their caseworker. And so their outreach staff goes out into the community. They like do events at the library and go talk to schools and do stuff like that to make sure these resources are out there, like especially their food insecurity resources. Like a lot of families use those. Mm-hmm. And that's like a preventative measure to prevent homelessness, obviously, is helping them with that financial burden. So that's part of the outreach hub. And then also the outreach hub is just a good way for young people struggling to connect with someone. So they kind of highlighted the outreach hub as like the only thing you need to do is walk in the door.
Okay.
And they'll connect you with those resources instead of having to like parse out all that information for yourself.
Yeah. Obviously, in our larger community and in the state in general, homelessness is such a huge issue.
It's a huge topic in Oregon.
It is. And I'm wondering too about this, and perhaps maybe as a general population, we don't think about this as much, but perhaps in your reporting, you learned, you know, how big of a challenge is youth homelessness?
Yeah, for sure. The staff sort of talked about, they definitely talked about prevention a lot, mm-hmm. and that it's not always like, I guess, the way that you think of homelessness. And okay. sometimes it really is just like food insecurity and coat for the winter and stuff like that is going to still push kids into that category of like, those aren't resources they can get for themselves. You know, you're not making the money usually. You're not like, so if your parents maybe aren't in that position or your family's in that position, they can come and help you with that. And that's still going to be categorized under the work that Jackson Street does. And all of the staff that I talked to, when they started working at Jackson Street, they realized like how many people you probably know when you're in high school who are like having those needs and those struggles around you. And they just like that Jackson Street can be as, I guess, as intense as you need it. That's the best way I can phrase it. Like they are, you know, giving you toothpaste, or they're connecting you with emergency housing, or they're connecting you with community support. Like they especially highlighted like kids who are maybe LGBT or in some other areas where mm-hmm. they're not having family support, and it's not necessarily due to lack of resources. It's due to, you know, emotional, moral problems.
Sure.
And they're really able to support you with that too. So I thought they were very interesting because it was different than how I would think of a youth homelessness nonprofit to run.
I see. Any indication that, you know, because of their success, because they've already expanded offerings, do you think that'll continue? They'll continue to expand, because obviously the need certainly seems to be there.
Yeah, I think so. They got a lot of support from Oregon Health Authority to expand this service center. That wasn't something I ended up being able to fit into the piece,
okay.
but was how I ended up finding out about it, was that Oregon Health Authority put that money into the service center, and Oregon is really seeing that need for centers like this to exist. So I think they would love to continue to expand. It seems like they do a lot of varied work in the community. I'm sure they have lots of big dreams to keep expanding their reach.
Sure. Yeah, I'm going to switch gears for a second, because there was another story you recently did at the end of January about the New Zone Artist Collective in Eugene. Tell us about that for a couple minutes.
I loved doing that story. The New Zone Artist Collective is pretty cool. It's been around for a while, and it's a like a artist-run collective and gallery where typically Eugene or Oregon-based artists can go and show their work. And then twice a year, they do this non-juried exhibit. A non-juried exhibit means that all the pieces that get submitted get put into it.
Okay.
Which I didn't know before doing this.
I've never heard that term before.
Neither had I. So that was like the first question I asked, what's a non-juried exhibit? So they open up twice a year their gallery to anyone in the area. You can submit up to 2 pieces of art, and they will get shown professionally, and they'll help you like sell them if you want to sell them.
Wow.
And get your sort of start showing art at the gallery.
Wow. What were some of the pieces? To talk about some of the pieces you were able to see.
It was, yeah, it was really cool in there because I went, their submissions are open right now. So okay. Zone for All doesn't start until March, I believe.
Okay.
But there was a huge variety. They show local, just starting out artists. I really liked, there was some very like abstract pieces by a younger artist. I think he was 18 and I really liked them. There was, he had like cool hand-drawn like color pencil, like swirls and clouds and stuff like that. Very abstract, patterny, colorful pieces. Yeah. And then there was an artist who was, did a lot of different portraiture, and I guess he's a pretty well-known local Oregon artist. There was stained glass in there, and it was like every type of medium, lots of jewelry, there was lots of ceramics. Who I interviewed in the piece, Diane Story Cunningham, she's a ceramicist. Mm. So her pieces that were in there right now were little like city scenes with little houses out of ceramics.
Wow, that's great. Almost tying two stories together, and you talked about, you know, a youth artist, and obviously we talked about youth homelessness services. It sounds great that there are these entities, these centers, these services cater towards, or at least very open to, kids.
Yeah, that was kind of my, like, I thought New Zone was so cool because of the variety of people that just anytime you walk in there, there's going to be such a variety of artists showcased. And Diane definitely talked to me about how they love getting those young artists in and that it's like really special for her as the like executive director of New Zone to see those like young artists like sell that first piece, hang stuff up in the gallery for the first time, get those experiences. So it is really cool to see more spaces for young people. I think we hear about a lot that like spaces for young people are disappearing and everyone's on their phones. So like it is really nice to see people putting in that community effort.
That's right. There may see more. They're a reporter with us here at KLCC talking about two of their recent stories they did. Macy, thanks so much for coming in and talking.
For sure. Thank you for letting me come in.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow on the show, you'll hear from our federal judge and hear about the rule of law and how executive branch overreach is seen from the federal bench. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.